Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. Our colleague to the right, Judge Rovner, is not with us physically today, but she is with us by an electronic connection. So if you hear a voice piping out of the walls, that will be Judge Rovner. Our first case for argument this morning is Halzell against Astru. Schutz.
May it please the court, counsel. I'm Julie Schutz. I represent Mary Halzell. On March 8, 2005, she filed an application for disability insurance benefits and supplemental security income. She was denied on application and reconsideration and had a hearing June 18th of 2007 and was denied on August 14, 2007. Mary's disability began on February 1, 2005. She testified that she had had surgery in 2004 on her neck, continued working for 9 months, and then just wasn't able to do it any longer because of a combination of impairments, including osteoarthritis in several anatomical areas, including her knees, her back. She had severe shoulder problems. She developed microscopic colitis. She was morbidly obese, and she suffered from type 2 diabetes. Now, this is a case where there's a combination of impairments that left her unable to perform even sedentary work. Yet the ALJ determined she was able to do light work based simply upon the fact that she found her not credible. However, Social Security Regulation 96.7P addresses the credibility factors when determining a residual functional capacity. And these factors weigh in favor of Mary. Her daily activities were severely limited. Now,
Could I interrupt, please?
Yes, please.
This is Judge Rovner coming in through the wall.
Yes.
Ms. Schutz, was there any specific evidence, apart from the parking placard evidence, that Ms. Halzell could not walk more than 200 feet?
Well, there was no, statement from a doctor saying that, aside from the parking placard, but the medical evidence showed that she was morbidly obese and had osteoarthritis of the knees and the back, which would render her unable to walk, as well as asthma, which left her with breathing difficulties. So I think the combination of the medical evidence suggests that she was unable to walk for a long distance, and then the parking placard on top of that was a doctor confirming that she couldn't walk more than 200 feet without becoming out of breath. Now, as I was stating, the daily activities, she never testified to being able to do anything other than sit and watch television and do puzzle crossword things for more than 10 to 15 minutes. Outside of attending some of her family or religious events, if she was able to sit or lie down at them. Now, these are severely limited in daily activity. She couldn't do housework. She couldn't go out and grocery shop. She was obviously severely limited, establishing the credibility. She consistently complained that of a location and duration of frequency of intense pain. She consistently complained to her primary care physician of neck pain, back pain, knee pain, shoulder pain, which led to the open shoulder surgery and 6 months of physical therapy, where she only met 75% of her goals. And even in the last physical therapy treatment, they were still suggesting that she had minimal complaints when they did the exercises. So clearly this didn't make her better and shows that she's credible when she says that her shoulders severely limited her and were painful. She also, during this time of getting the shoulder surgery and the 6 months of intense physical therapy 2 to 3 times a week, suffered from microscopic colitis, which meant she ended up going to the hospital on frequent occasions and caused her severe abdominal pain and diarrhea, which she testified still was ongoing and required her to use the bathroom 6 times a week and be near a bathroom.
So would you then maintain that the ALJ over-the-counter medication?
Yes, I would say that she testified that while the treatment seemed to help somewhat, it was still causing her problems and still requiring frequent use of the bathroom. I think there's a difference between, she no longer goes to the hospital doubled over in pain, but that doesn't mean she doesn't still have the issues with diarrhea that renders her unable to sit at a job for 8 hours a day because of her frequent need to use the bathroom. And you have to remember, too, that Ms. Hossel testified that she was given temporary Medicaid for her shoulder surgery and outside of that had no medical insurance. So her ability to get to her doctor and seek treatment was very limited because she didn't have the means. She was a manager of a fast food restaurant until 2005 and then didn't work for two years at all. She didn't have the income to go see a doctor. She didn't have the insurance. So she was just unable to get as much treatment. So she did the bare essentials, I guess. And the only reason she was able to do the shoulder surgery in the first place was because they gave her temporary Medicaid. So you can hardly fault her for not seeking more treatment. I mean, it's a world where she just wasn't able to get the treatment. She didn't have the income or the resources. Additionally, she did have a good earnings record until she quit work. I mean, from 1995 to 2004, the end of 2004, she had a steady work record, which lends credence to her credibility. She was not a shirker trying to get out of working. The ALJ faulted her for not seeing her orthopedic physician for her other orthopedic issues outside of her shoulder. But again, she was at the mercy of the system. She had temporary Medicaid for the shoulder, and whether or not her primary care physician was able to refer her further for the other osteopathic issues or osteoarthritis issues was really up to them. And she complained continually to her primary care physician about her other pain, and she just wasn't referred further. Further, the ALJ stated that she quit her job to be near her grandchildren, which wasn't her testimony at all. Her testimony was, I quit my job for health reasons. After she was done working, then she moved closer to her family, which, you know, makes sense, closer to a means of support. She didn't have any income at this time. You know, moving closer to her family shouldn't be a reason to find her not credible. And then the statement that she had a normal colonoscopy, well, technically, the colonoscopy didn't show anything, but the biopsy report from the exact same day showed the microscopic colitis. So there's no denying that she had this colitis, and this was an issue.
I don't think the question here, counsel, is about the nature of her various physical ailments, medical conditions,
right?
But whether they render her disabled, and there is no treating physician who offered that opinion that she was disabled based on these medical conditions, nor were there any vocational experts who offered that opinion either. So the case really depends entirely on her credibility, and the ALJ discredited her testimony as exaggerated.
Well, except that, I mean, you say there's no treating physician that says she's totally disabled. We have a treating physician who gives her the handicap parking placard. You know, I mean, I agree that's not obviously a statement that she's completely disabled, but
yeah, that's a very different inquiry than eligibility for disability benefits.
Right, but he's still saying that she's credible in her ailments and what she's saying. I mean, unfortunately,
that's not in question. What is in question is whether her ailments totally disable her for purposes of a benefits determination.
Right.
And the handicap parking placard is irrelevant to that.
Well, I think it lends credence to her credibility because it does come down to a credibility issue because, unfortunately, not every person who applies for Social Security can get a doctor to fill out a form saying that they're totally disabled. I mean, that's just the way it is. We're talking about a woman who is at the mercy of free clinics, and getting a free clinic doctor to author an opinion, it's just not always possible. And as for the vocational expert not rendering the opinion that she couldn't work, the vocational expert's hypothetical was based on what the ALJ gave, the limitations the ALJ gave the VE, which was for light work. And that requires at least some walking, and we do have the handicap placard saying that She can't even walk 200 feet, so that alone would be enough to show that the hypothetical wasn't complete to the VE. I see that I'm almost out of time. If there are any other questions, if there aren't any other questions, I'll. All right. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Mr. Wolfring.
Good morning, Your Honors, counsel. May it please the court, my name is Luke Waltering on behalf of the commissioner. Substantial evidence in this case supports the ALJ's decision that Ms. Halsell could do her past relevant work, as well as a significant number of other jobs in the national economy, and she is therefore not disabled under the Social Security Act. Ms. Halsell, in her brief, and as the court has indicated today, has indicated that credibility is a central issue in this case. And this court has long held that an ALJ's credibility finding is entitled to special deference. This court has also held that a claimant's symptoms alone cannot establish that she is disabled. And in this case, the ALJ considered other pieces of evidence, other significant evidence that indicated otherwise.
Mr. Waltering, the ALJ concluded that Ms. Halsell continues to engage in a range of activities. But from the record, it's not completely clear to me what daily activities she means. Do you know?
Your Honor, judging from the ALJ's decision, it was essentially she was going through the number of different factors that she was required to go through under the regulations, and one of those factors is that she had to consider the claimant's daily activities. So it's our understanding that the ALJ simply stated that she had daily activities in her brief, and that was not it's certainly not the main reason that she found Ms. Halsell not credible, but it was just essentially she just wanted to indicate that claimant did have, or that Ms. Halsell did have some activities.
I know, but did you consider that to be enough for the ALJ to simply state she has a range of activities without going into what the activities are? I've rarely seen that in our decision.
Yes, Your Honor, and I think that if the ALJ would have simply stated that she had a range of activities and would have based the decision on that, then that would have been a problem in this case. But the ALJ pointed to several other pieces of evidence that indicated that Ms. Halsell's credibility was not entirely credible, and that Ms. Halsell's daily activities, though possibly limited, were not indicative of what she could actually do in a day-to-day work environment.
But how are we supposed to know what that is? There's a mystery here. I mean, one of the ALJ's conclusions was that she hadn't been prescribed any significant pain medication regimen. And that, for instance, was simply incorrect, because the record showed that she was prescribed medication for long-term pain management. She was taking amitriptyline, which the ALJ seems to assume is exclusively a sleep aid, but in reality, it is commonly used for pain management.
Well, Your Honor, that is an antidepressant type medication, and Ms. Halsell did testify that she was only taking that medication once per day, and she only took it just before bedtime, and she said that it did help her sleep. So I don't know if that's where the ALJ is gathering that information, but Ms. Halsell was also asked if she took any other pain medication, and she said that she wouldn't even take Tylenol because it kept her awake during the day. And so it's questionable when she won't take Tylenol because the only side effect is that it keeps her awake during the day, and Then on the other hand, she claims that she has severe disabling pain. So, Your Honor, it's inconsistent with her statements of disabling pain.
Well, I don't know. There are a lot of people that would prefer, when given the sort of between a rock and a hard place choice, would prefer to sleep at night and try and just deal with the pain. So I'm not quite sure how relevant any of that really is.
And again, Your Honor, that was another factor that the ALJ considered, but additional factors are that there was no medical opinion before the ALJ indicating that she had any impairment or combination of impairments that would disable her from working. And even her own family physician, Dr. Kirkpatrick, when she indicated to him that she was applying for disability, she said that he had no comment on this issue. She was actually referred by Dr. Kirkpatrick to Dr. Wheeler for her knee impairment, but once she started treatment with him, she was treated solely for the shoulder issue. And after the surgery on her shoulder, during that entire course of treatment, she never sought any further treatment for her knees or her back with him. And at the end of that treatment, she'd also gone through some physical therapy for her shoulder. And neither Dr. Wheeler nor the physical therapist indicated any permanent restrictions on her functional abilities. The one medical opinion that was in the record that the ALJ indicated in her opinion was that of Dr. Belinsky. And Dr. Belinsky opined that Ms. Halsall could perform light work. And this was supported by the objective medical evidence in the record. As the ALJ pointed out, the imaging studies done of Ms. Halsall's knees and her back were consistently noted as mild osteoarthritic changes, minimal osteoarthritic changes. There's no doubt that she did have osteoarthritis in her knees and her back, and that this would have caused her some pain. But at issue is that substantial evidence simply did not support the degree of limitation that she alleged she had. Rather, as supported by Dr. Belinsky's opinion, the minimal findings from the objective medical evidence and her conservative treatment and her failure to seek further treatment from her orthopedic specialist, Ms. Halsall's impairments only caused her a minimal degree of limitation, and this was certainly accommodated by the ALJ through her limitation to light work. And I would also like to point out that the ALJ did not even stop there. Once she asked the vocational expert if Ms. Halsall could perform her past relevant work, the vocational expert clearly testified that she could perform that work as it was generally performed in the national economy. But the ALJ even went on to step five, a step further, and heard evidence from the vocational expert that Ms. Halsall could also perform a significant number of other jobs in the national economy. And this was not just light jobs. Even though the vocational expert testified she could perform almost 750,000 light jobs in the national economy, she also heard testimony from the vocational expert that Ms. Halsall could perform 435,000 sedentary jobs. So for these reasons, Your Honors, we ask that the court affirm the commissioner's decision.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, counsel. Anything further, Ms. Schutz?
Thank you, Your Honor. I just wanted to make one brief point about the Social Security relying on Dr. Belinsky's opinion, which was given on June 7th of 2005, 3 months after her application, and it was before the benefit of the years of treatment she had after 2005 and the shoulder surgery and the colitis and the diabetes. So it's really unfair to rely on this light RFC since it was 2 years before the hearing and before any of the significant medical treatment, really. So I would just suggest that that RFC is not credible. It comes down to a credibility issue, and if you look at how poorly the credibility was evaluated in the ALJ's decision and see that the factors weigh in favor of her credibility, you'd see that she could perform less than sedentary work and would be rendered disabled. Thank you.
Thank you very much, counsel. The case is taken under advisement.